The following recording by the LA Sound Posse is a lecture given by Dr. Ira Sohn on June 18th of 2004 in Santa Monica, California. The talk was sponsored by the Southern California Federation of Scientists and the Monthly Review Discussion Group. The lecture was titled, The Materialist Conception of History. Dr. Sohn holds degrees in physics and economics and currently teaches economics at universities both in the U.S. and China. The complete talk has been divided into three parts, and this is part one.
To give you a little background on me, I do go to China regularly, and I lecture there in two different ways. I do lecture, as Shell indicated, in MBA courses, in business courses, and I give the same sort of lectures in China as anyone teaching in MBA programs here would give. Mostly, I specialize in managerial economics, contemporary economics, strategy, business ethics, which is kind of my favorite course. The Chinese, too, they find it really interesting to discover, you know, what American business is really like. They became quite interested after the Enron scandals. Because prior to that, they thought America is this wonderful, perfect, well-oiled economic machine. But then there was the dot-com collapse, the Wall Street collapse. But really, what changed their minds was the accounting-related scandals. Because then they realized, well, the Americans are exactly like us. They just have a slightly different system. What they were really worried about is, you know, if we make the transition to capitalism, can we do the same things? And I sort of assured them it was possible, and they were comforted. So that's interesting. I also teach other courses in finance, things like that in China, which is my way of getting to China and getting paid for it. However, I'm much more interested in working for or under the auspices of the Beijing Communist Party School because they have me give lectures not only in Beijing, a bunch of schools there. They control 90 schools, in fact, in that city alone. But also they send me to capital cities all over China where I give lectures not on, you know, managerial economics, but I analyze China's development, where it is now, where I think it's likely to go, and also China's place in East Asia and East Asia's place in Eurasia. As you probably know, the Chinese economy and the Indian economy are galloping now, but they're not the only ones that are doing that. These societies are all coalescing along with Europe into a kind of single entity, single economic entity. It'll take decades before it firms up, but what's happening there is really not terribly different from NAFTA or from the EU. The world is undergoing regional economic integration, and obviously the rules of the game, the political rules of the game, will be changing very rapidly. It's quite conceivable that in the not distant future, maybe 15, 20, 25 years from now, the United States will simply be one more power and not the superpower that we take for granted. Perhaps someday I could give a lecture on what's going on in the Middle East. And it seems to me that what the U.S. is up to there is a sign not of its power, but of its desperation. It's precisely because its economic hegemony is waning that it's resorting to military means to preserve its position at the top of the heap. So that's the sort of thing I really like discussing in China. And I go around to a lot of big cities, and it's fascinating just seeing that society develop, and it is developing into a capitalist society. There's just no question about that, and there are no pretenses any longer on the part of the Communist Party that something else is happening. They talk about socialism with Chinese characteristics. In my opinion, it's capitalism with Chinese characteristics. And they talk about market socialism, which is a contradiction in terms. The fact that it is gravitating toward capitalism makes my talk, or the interest in Marxism, I think all the more relevant, because there's a convergence going on in the world, with the exception maybe of Papua New Guinea or the Trobriand Islands, where people, you know, sort of are still in the Stone Age. The whole world, wherever they may have started from, is converging toward capitalism. And in fact, it corresponds to the prediction Marx made in 1848, the Communist Manifesto, that eventually capitalism would spread to the whole world and there would be a global capitalist system. Those of you who've never read the manifesto will probably be very surprised when you read it, because it sounds like it was written today. I don't know if that I'll have much time to discuss the manifesto today, but I guess I'm mentioning all this to give you a sense of the relevance of Marxism. Marxism's death has been predicted regularly. And yet somehow, like a phoenix, it always manages to rise up out of the ashes. And I believe the explanation for that is that sooner or later, the oppressiveness of capitalism exerts itself. And therefore, sooner or later, people must take up the only rational analysis of the crisis that they're facing. We tend, most of us here probably, tend to pay our taxes on April 14th. And human beings are just like that. They put off certain things until they have no choice. So Marxism could be put off, or Marx's ideas about the nature of class struggle can be put off only so long. When any economy, any capitalist economy goes into crisis, there's only one place to turn. And it's not microeconomics, and it's not macroeconomics. It's not anything that's taught in business schools. It's exactly what isn't taught in American universities, and that's Marxism. There are some universities, of course, who have a few radicals. I understand Europe has, more Marxist courses, but it's not as though it's the dominant thing that's taught. And so that's why I'm here tonight. It's just hard to find out what Marx really said. And not so much because what he said is difficult to understand, but there's a political dimension to what he said. And obviously, the capitalists who run the society are not really thrilled to have professors at UCLA or Harvard or whatever teaching a theory that says that their reign is very limited and that it'll eventually be ended all over the world. So having said that, let me get to Marx's ideas. Marx had one central idea. People generally think of it as two ideas. One is the materialist conception of history. Now, he applied that to the capitalist system, what he called the capitalist mode of production, and he spent probably 30 years analyzing capitalism. And there was a book published in his lifetime, Volume 1 of Capital, that he was satisfied with, and unfortunately he died at about the age of 65 with a gigantic manuscript left to be edited down, and it was done so by his collaborator Engels, and also by a man by the name of Karl Kautsky. And those manuscripts were published as volumes 2 and 3 of Capital, but it's sort of a roundup of a lot of things that he never had time to organize. If I have time, I will discuss his theory of how capitalism actually operates as expressed in volume 1 of Capital. But most of this lecture will really be devoted to the materialist conception of history, which he himself regarded as his main contribution to human thought. Now, it's sort of a heavy phrase, the materialist conception of history or historical materialism. What's really involved? And before I go into it, let me say it's a pretty simple idea. I think, almost anyone in this society above the age of 10 maybe could understand it. That's not the problem. There's a political dimension to that idea, which means that not too many people know about it. Now, roughly speaking, all of the theories that have been put forth about society, whether they're political or philosophical or religious or even aesthetic, can be grouped in one of two camps: philosophic idealism and philosophic materialism. And Marx and a few other thinkers, some who functioned several thousand years ago, in fact, are in the materialist camp. He was not the first person to come up with some sort of materialist conception of history. But the overwhelming majority of thinkers, religious leaders, founders of various political movements, belong in the camp of philosophic idealism. So, what is philosophic idealism? It's really very simple. It's the notion that humanity is moved by a great idea, a great philosophy, a great religion, perhaps a great aesthetic conception. And generally, the idea or set of ideas is attributed to a great thinker. It could be Plato, it could be Confucius, it could be Muhammad, it could be Immanuel Kant, but some individual or small group of individuals comes up with a brilliant idea. And this idea is so attractive to other people, eventually millions of other people, that they try to live by it or try to implement it in some fashion. And so from the perspective of philosophic idealism, human history can be traced as the progression of great ideas. You might want to, if you're interested in Western society, you might want to start with maybe Pythagoras, and then you go to Plato and Aristotle and Aquinas, and you wind up with John Locke, the big philosophic names. And each is supposedly building on the work of his or her predecessors. And so all of human understanding, so far as society is concerned, can be grouped that way. Let me give an example to be concrete. An ultra-idealist, I guess you could call him, would be Plato. Plato believed, and you know, you can read about it in all of his Socratic dialogues, that somehow independently of human beings, there exist ideas or ideals. The ideal of justice, the ideal of truth, the ideal of courage, the ideal of beauty. By the way, sometimes it's translated as idea. My Greek isn't good enough to, I don't know any Greek, so I don't know which is the best translation, but there are these conceptions that exist independently of humanity. And human beings have some way of absorbing these ideas. So that if a person has a conception of justice, it's because he or she was able to kind of make contact with something out there. Now, some people spend all their time pondering the ideals. And these are called philosophers, literally those who love knowledge. And so they have the best grasp of the notion of justice, courage, maybe how a state should be organized. And they're sort of like people who spend all their time learning carpentry or learning physics or practicing football. I mean, if you spend a lot of time at something, chances are you're going to become pretty good at it. And they make their discoveries about these ideals known to others. They live according to them. And other people who are not really experts in the absorption of ideas or ideals, they try to imitate them. And they build a whole society or a system of laws and traditions and mores upon the words of people like Socrates and Plato. And Plato's proof of this would be, well, just look around you. I mean, everybody thinks this statue by Praxiteles is really beautiful. Well, why do we all agree that it's beautiful? It's because we're kind of cluing in, we're tapping in to this ideal. And in fact, in the Republic, Plato says, well, who should rule a society? Well, it should be philosophers. There should be a philosopher king, because who has a better idea of the ideas? Philosophers, people who spend all their time learning about justice. So they should rule the society, and people less steeped in the lore should follow their lead. Of course, Plato himself was a philosopher, so this notion that philosophers should be kings was a little self-serving. He was also a member of the aristocracy, so he wasn't far from being at the top anyway. But you could see the drift. When it's theologians who are putting forward some kind of idealist system, they're generally emphasizing the central significance of theology or knowing God. They're not knowing ideals, they're knowing God or God's will. When it's more modern people, they may be existentialists or whatever. They say they're going to guide humanity through the labyrinth of confusion that we see in contemporary society. I don't know that any of them are really advertising that they should be rulers, but if you look at the neocons, you know, that surround Bush, to one degree or another, they're all sort of acolytes of a philosopher by the name of Leo Strauss. And he definitely put forward a doctrine of a kind of covert seizure of power by an intellectual elite. And that's how they conceive of themselves. So there have been different versions of philosophic idealism, but generally they're put forward by intellectuals or priests or something like that, and usually they're the star act. Somehow humanity should follow them, and if it does, it'll be in good shape, and if not, well, there'll be, you know, disasters. So I could go into other major thinkers. Confucius was one of them. Almost all the major thinkers, secular or religious, have been philosophic idealists. Now, these days, you also have psychologists who say, well, people are sort of in the grip of archetypes or the Oedipus complex or the death wish or something, and that's what's moving them. But again, it sort of boils down to incorrect conceptions or maybe sometimes correct conceptions of what life is all about. And I don't think there's any point in going into more of them in detail. I think you get the idea. So let's switch over now to various materialist conceptions of history. There have been a few. One very famous Chinese philosopher, he's sort of like Machiavelli, he wrote about political organization. His name is Han Fei. Another is James Madison, you know, one of the founding fathers. Most famous, of course, is Marx. But Marx is coming from a certain tradition. To give you the flavor of this, let me tell you about Han Fei. Chinese society was in a state of warfare for about 2.5 centuries. In fact, it still is called the era of the warring states. And it went on for about 260 years, and you can just imagine what life is like. There were 7 kingdoms fighting one another in different combinations perpetually, and many people died. It was just horrendous. And eventually, things kind of quieted down with the founding of the first empire, the establishment of the Qin dynasty. And basically, the Qin emperor just conquered all the other kings and established a bureaucratic state. Before then, China was a feudal state. in that there were hereditary rulers of different regions that owed allegiance to various kings. But the first emperor abolished all that, and he established a bureaucracy, very much like a contemporary bureaucracy in China. Nothing has changed in 2,000 years. He came to power in 221 BC, and pretty much China has been like that. And how else could it be? I mean, you have a gigantic society. It's spread over an area that's about the size of the United States, hundreds of millions of people, and you have to have rational organization. But, of course, lots of people are going to resist. They don't want to go along with being conscripted into the army for 30 years. They don't want to be enslaved building a great wall for the rest of their lives or surrendering a lot of what they produce to the state under the watch of mandarins who are really administrators. And so Han Fei was the most important person of the legalist tradition. Confucius is the other important philosopher in China. He founded the Confucian tradition, and those are the big traditions in China. Now, what was Confucius's line? Well, he was an idealist, and he felt that there is such a thing as virtuous behavior, which everyone can acknowledge to be virtuous. It meant not lying, not cheating, not stealing, being kind, being responsible, especially if you were a ruler. You're not supposed to misuse your power. You're supposed to be responsible to the people you rule, and they, in turn, if you are responsible, should be obedient to you. It was a system of mutuality. And so the way Confucius accounted for the turmoil that China had been in for centuries, and it was occasionally plunged into, huge civil wars, he said the problem is people lose their way. Life is a very complicated affair, and it's easy to give in to ignoble impulses. But he said humanity is basically good, and there are some exemplary individuals who somehow always know the right way. They always know the path of virtue. So they should stick to that path, and they should be examples to everyone else. And if there are enough examples like that, people will stop killing and cheating and stealing, you know, what they do today and what they did in his time, and there would be a kind of humane social order. And the idea of virtue then would sort of establish itself as almost the only idea. And then you wouldn't need a strong state, because people wouldn't do those kind of things that the state punishes. Now, Han Fei comes along a few centuries after Confucius, just about the time that the empire is founded, and it's going from feudal to bureaucratic, and he says, no, Confucius was wrong, or at least wrong for our time. He said, way back when, Confucius is always referring to a golden age, thousands of years before. In that time, there were very few people in China, so land was abundant. Everybody had, you know, a plot of land to work. There was no starvation, and therefore, people didn't cheat and lie and steal and kill, etc. Therefore, the state didn't have to be very strong because there was very little incentive to behave antisocially. The Han Fei says, well, things have changed. Now there are many people without land, and so there's a big incentive for selfish, greedy, antisocial behavior. Therefore, trying to use virtuous people as models to get everybody else to behave civilly is ridiculous. It can't be. So he said, forget about morality. Forget about a state based on morality. Forget about exemplary human beings. And just let's have a system of rigorous laws. You violate the law, you get severely punished. You do something to help people, you're immediately rewarded. What this is based on is just pragmatism. This is what works for a huge empire. It has nothing to do with morality. And so you could consider Han Fei to be a very early materialist. He's saying people are not guided by ideas, they're guided by their interest, their material interest. And the state should be premised on that. And if you want an orderly state where you know people are kind of surviving from day to day, it has to be pragmatic. It cannot be based on great moral conceptions. It can't be based on virtue or sages or you know what was Confucius really like. You just have to be practical. Eventually, legalism, which is what the system he headed because he believed in the importance of laws, rules, regulations, and the enforcement of them by police forces, armies, the state, that passed out of vogue, not entirely, but mostly, and Confucianism was reinstalled as the official ideology. And what you actually see in China these days is a kind of combination of both. The communists by no means kind of shed 3,000 or 4,000 years of baggage. And now they're moving in a capitalist direction, so who knows what their official ideology will be 20 years from now. But until now, it really has been an admixture of both legalism and Confucianism. So, you know, it's another important example, in my opinion, of a materialist. One closer to us, as I mentioned, was James Madison. He was probably the most astute political analyst of the Founding Fathers. And if you read the Federalist Papers, if you read his essays and the sort of transcripts of conversations he had, you see, I mean, he sort of stood above people like Jefferson and Adams, who were also, you know, the writers of the Federalist Papers. And they wrote a lot on politics. And he made a number of statements in his life because he was deeply involved with Congress, and eventually he became president. He said factions are based on interest. In other words, when someone gets up in the House of Representatives and advocates some kind of a law or a bill, he'll state it in sort of philosophic terms, or it's sort of good for everybody in America if this law is passed. What Madison was really saying is, yeah, it's good for him and his group. And he's, in Marxist terms, he's trying to make the particular interest seem the general interest. And this is done constantly all over the world for thousands of years. If there's a special group with its own interests, it needs to recruit support, especially if it's a very small minority. And one of the ways of doing that is to propagandize, to try to get people to agree with you that the invasion of Iraq is good, or the passage of a certain tax bill is good, or, you know, or maybe just putting in a sidewalk is a good thing. So Madison, in some ways, can be described as a materialist. Also, a lot of the French Enlightenment philosophers came pretty close to saying a lot of the things that Marx eventually said in a much more systematic and scientific way, as we'll see. So Marx is by no means without precedent, but what really sets him off against all the rest was that he was the inheritor of the scientific tradition that had been completely worked out by the time of the French Enlightenment. And in fact, he was living at a time when modern industry was just charging over the landscape of Western Europe and, of course, the United States. So a highly rationalistic and scientific outlook was there. It had been developed for him. And in fact, there were various thinkers such as Auguste Comte, who founded what's today called bourgeois sociology, and the people working in sort of the early stages of anthropology and psychology, who said in the tradition of the Enlightenment, well, let's try to apply scientific principles to society, whether it's large numbers of people or individuals. Because after all, if we can understand the stars and the planets and chemicals and, you know, everything else in scientific terms, why shouldn't society be understood in scientific terms? What the principles are was kind of remain to be seen, but society should not be exempt from scientific rational examination. And that meant forgetting about gods and mysterious forces and parapsychology. I mean, everything we have today has been around for centuries. And let's just treat humans maybe as well, they didn't have electrons as a conception, but, you know, let's treat society in an objective scientific manner. And they tried, and they had kind of mixed success. Diderot, for example, wrote the famous encyclopedia where he, you know, he just tried to describe everything that people knew about. That's hardly a scientific explanation, but it's kind of a beginning. Also, Linnaeus functioned at that time, and he was trying to catalog all living organisms. How they got that way, he didn't know, but at least you have a foundation. So Marx is inheriting a lot of that, and he begins to, around the early 1840s, he was in his early, mid-20s around then, he begins seriously to apply the scientific method to society. And it took maybe 20 years, 15 to 20 years, before it was all firmed up. He was a pioneer in this field. As I said, there had been people before him kind of speculating, but no one with the rigor and scholarship that he had. He read voluminously in many, many different things. So he was able to kind of synthesize his theory based on his understanding of how real societies had evolved, and also on the basis of, you know, the scientific method, an objective way of understanding the world. Now, what was his conception of history? I've mentioned some other materialist conceptions, but his is really distinctive. Before I give you his explicitly, let me invite you to a Halloween party. I'm putting on the party, and I invite you to it on a certain condition. The condition is that you wear a costume that I will supply you. Just agree to wear it, and you get invited. And you say, okay. And I say, there's going to be good food and music and interesting guests, and you'll have a good time. So the costume is delivered to you an hour before the party. You put it on, you go to the party. And at the end, I go up to you and I ask you, how did you enjoy yourself? And you say, oh, it was a good time. I like the food, I like the people I met, etc. So then I ask you, well, you seem to spend all of your time sort of leaning against this particular wall. Why did you do that? And you say, well, I guess I did. And you say, well, you know, the lighting was less harsh. And also the music is kind of loud. Right over here, it's not too loud. And the food is kind of within arm's reach. And also I met one or two really interesting people who happened to be at that part of the party. So that's why. And then I say to you, well, could it have had something to do with the fact that the costume I supplied you has little particles of iron in it, and there's a very powerful electromagnet on the other side of the wall? And you say, well, maybe. Maybe that had something to do with it. So I offer this as a really simple model of the materialist conception of history, according to Marx. Suppose that instead of one person, you have a group of people with some kind of common interest. It could be international bankers who, you know, regularly socialize with one another, or it could be bus drivers, or it could be factory workers, or whatever. And they socialize. They talk with one another about things that matter. And let us say that instead of an electromagnet, there are their material interests, their most important material interests. If it's a group of factory workers, well, their interests center on the wage. What is the wage? Is it enough to live on? Who's making more? Who's making less? Who is cheated out of a few hours of wage? What are the working conditions like? How fast are we obliged to work? What about health and safety conditions? There's a lot of lint that could explode. We're breathing in this stuff. It's going to cause black lung or brown lung. The fire exits aren't proper. There aren't enough fire extinguishers. Sometimes we're made to work 14 hours a day, and there's a danger of injuring yourself on the machinery. So they're always discussing these things because this is their most important material interest. When bankers get together, as you can imagine, you know, they have a different perspective. They have a different interest. When industrialists get together, still a different interest. So what Marx was saying is that the philosophies that come out of people, by philosophies I mean religious conceptions, ideas, worldviews, they are developed by groups of people, not by one person, not by one great thinker, but by groups of people who consistently interact and influence one another in their thinking. Maybe one person initiates the idea, but it goes round and round and round, and after a few weeks or months, it's a well-developed theory of some kind. Now, no one is forcing anyone to believe this theory, but we are wired to believe in some theory, aside from people, you know, who are born cognitively defective. That is part of what it means to be human, to have a worldview of some sort. It could be a, you know, belief in gods and spirits, or it could be the scientific worldview, but we must have that. And we are also social beings. We, aside from people who choose to live in the middle of the desert forever, which are, you know, very rare, we need one another. We are biologically or cognitively constituted to interact with others, and the people we're likely to interact with are people like ourselves. I mean, I don't think David Rockefeller hung out with the people who worked at the filling stations that his family owned. He would, you know, associate with other bankers and, you know, high-level politicians. So society tends to group itself in these ways where people with a similar interest kind of hang out and they communicate with one another and they develop ideologies or worldviews that correspond to their material interest. They're not arbitrary. They are reflections, you could say idea reflections, of what their material interests are. If workers want a higher wage, it's not sort of an abstract question to them. It's because the wage that they have isn't enough to sustain them in whatever, you know, level of consumption that they already have. So their material interest in that case is being expressed pretty directly. When the factory that employs them tries to hold the wage down and has all kinds of reasons for doing that, well, it's obvious that it's the material interest of the owner or owners that's driving that. They can come up with reasons from now till eternity as to why it's not a good idea to raise the wage. And the workers correspondingly will come up with lots of reasons for why it's a good idea to raise the wage. So what Marx is saying is that in a society that's divided into classes, in other words, different groups with different material interests, that there is not just a class struggle going on, not just the workers trying to get more money out of the owners, but there's an ideological struggle going on that is a reflection of what's happening in the economic realm. Now, the reflections can be pretty fantastic when you think of all the ideas that humanity has ever put forward. They're very diverse. But Marx would say that apart from the imaginings of psychotics, the principal ideas of humanity always are in some way reflections of their material interest. And things turn out to be pretty complicated because, to the best of my knowledge, the working class of this society does not own any TV broadcast networks or radio networks or major newspapers, etc., whereas billionaires do. And so, as you can imagine, the ideological apparatus of this society, by and large, is controlled by the capitalist class. And the ideas developed and projected by the ideological apparatus are those ideas that correspond to the interests of that class. Now, lots of people watch television, not just millionaires, but ordinary people. And if they hear the same argument again and again that Saddam Hussein has weapons of mass destruction, or he's in league with Osama bin Laden, etc., well, what do most people in the United States know about Iraq? Zero. So since lots of experts are coming at them from many different angles, saying the same thing, and the president, whom they respect, says the same thing, they say, well, yeah, Iraq is a threat, and it's our patriotic duty to go and fight and maybe give our lives. Because look at what happened September 11th. Maybe Saddam Hussein is planning the same thing or is subsidizing something like that. And so it is possible for people to absorb ideas that do not correspond to their material interest. A lot depends on the apparatus, the institutions that develop and distribute ideas. And since the workers, don't have control over that apparatus, by default, a lot of times, they absorb ideas that come straight from the ruling class, and they incorporate it into their worldview. Now, we are not digital computers like that. So we are not bound to be logical. Our reasoning is biological, which means we can entertain several completely contradictory ideas at the same time. So you question someone about Iraq, and they might say, yeah, we were basically duped by the Bush administration. And then you say, well, should we get out? No. Because the Sunnis and the Shiites don't get along. If we got out, they'd kill one another. And who knows what would happen in Palestine. And so the U.S. should stay in. Well, it's very complicated. And, just try to reason with someone in a consistent manner. People are not clinging to ideas just because they're logical or mathematical. They're clinging to ideas on the basis of their material interest or what they think their interest is and what they heard in the news on the news in the morning. And then their ideas may change because there's a different kind of news report in the evening that says Saddam Hussein was not, in fact, in league with Osama bin Laden. And so people vacillate, they change. Their ideas are really not stable. They're constantly altering. Are the ideas you entertain today the same that you entertained when you were 30 years old or 20 years old or 5 years old? And we're not aware of these changes, but obviously they're happening all the time. We have some sort of mechanism in our brains that sort of disguises that from us. It kind of wallpapers over everything. So we always think we're completely consistent. I mean, if you know a person well enough, you can trap him or her into contradicting herself or himself. And it's because we are biological. Our brains are biological things. They're more like livers than they are like digital computers. And we evolved to be like that. So that gives you some idea of Marx's version of the materialist conception of history, and it seems to me to be eminently reasonable. Let me give some really far-out examples of how it works. For instance, abstract expressionism, where smears and blobs are on the canvas. Jackson Pollock, I guess, is the most famous one. And it evolved in America. It was based on things that had been done in Europe a few decades earlier, such as Dadaism, Surrealism, even Impressionism, but it was the Americans who really, put that on the map. And interestingly enough, in the late 40s and early 50s, the State Department, the U.S. State Department, sponsored traveling exhibitions of the paintings and sculptors of America's most important abstract expressionists. Now, what in the world does that have to do with the materialist conception of history? These paintings are abstract. They don't show any concrete object. I mean, Jackson Pollock is the one, I guess, most famous. I mean, he would just take cans of paint and fling them against the canvas and smear them around. Different artists had different versions of doing that, but, they deliberately avoided representation of anything in the real world. They had a theory that what we really respond to in a painting is sort of shapes and contours. And making these shapes and contours assume the form of a bowl of fruit is just kind of conventional. We can get away from that and just present the shapes and contours disassociated from any real object, and that too should be considered beautiful. And I don't want to get into, you know, whether it's a correct theory, but that's what they believed. And the State Department, of all institutions, was spending tremendous amounts of money sending exhibitions of the leading works of these artists all over the world, Europe and the Third World. So how could the materialist conception of history account for that? Well, it can't until you realize that what the Soviet Union was sponsoring in its exhibitions was what they called socialist realism. You know, farmer on tractor, the tractor is red, the farmer is wearing red, and there's a red sunset, then he's determined to bring in the crop. It was very literal, it was very idealized, it was very much rooted in Soviet Union's ideology. And the U.S. and the Soviet Union at that time, the late 40s, throughout the 50s, and even a lot of the 60s, were waging an ideological struggle, trying to convince the unconvinced, which is most of the people in the world, that their way is best. Why did the Soviet Union put up Sputnik? All it did was beep. It just went beep, 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 beep. It didn't do anything. But that was the first artificial satellite, and the Soviet Union was addressing India. It was addressing Pakistan. It was addressing Indonesia and Brazil, saying, choose sides. Are you with us? We got, you know, into space first. You want to go with the Americans? Well, they're not even there yet. That forced the Americans to do something much more spectacular than just a beeper, and that's put human beings on the moon. They knew the Soviet technology was not equal to that. They weren't sure that their own technology was equal to that, but they thought, we can do that. Well, then those people in India and Indonesia and Pakistan and Brazil, they're going to pay attention to us. They'll side with us. So that's why abstract expressionism was so appealing to the State Department and, you know, other propagandists, because they were saying, look at the Soviet Union. It dictates the painting style of creative people. Maybe it's sort of like a factory producing one tractor after, you know, one painted tractor after another. It could be a worker in a factory or, you know, whatever. It's the same thing, and it's done on the order of the state. The intellectuals have been completely subordinated to the state. If they don't like what Stalin wants, they could get killed. Whereas, look at us. We don't dictate anything. And our artists aren't even depicting real things. They're not trying to glorify America. You can't recognize America in anything ever produced by Jackson Pollock. This is completely free artistic expression, and it is not state subsidized. You know, we are subsidizing it, the exhibition moving around the world, but we never commissioned these things. The artists never seek our approval. So that just shows the difference between the Soviet Union, where intellectuals are slaves, and the United States, where they're completely free to do anything they want, including stuff that most people can't even understand. You can analyze a lot of things that seem to be just sort of arbitrary and say, well, they're not quite arbitrary. There's a political dimension to what's going on. You'd suspect as much if you heard that the State Department was spending millions of dollars to send these exhibitions around the world. They also, in that period, especially the 60s, liked to send jazz artists around the world. Now, probably 95% of the jazz artists were black. Why are they sending them around the world? Well, the world had the impression that America was a racist society. It was an easy thing to get that impression. When you, you know, see cops in the South with cattle prods, tormenting black people. The U.S. was notorious for that. But if the State Department can say, see, we are sending black artists around the world. We're giving them privileged treatment. We're not racists. We don't oppress anyone. Well, yeah, there are some people who are a little backward, people in Mississippi, but we don't condone that. Malcolm X pointed out that John Kennedy appointed nothing but racists to the bench in the South, but somehow the State Department missed out on that one. So these artists, who themselves were innocent, they're delighted to have a chance to go around the world. They become pawns in a very big game, a very big, serious game. How many people were persuaded by Louis Armstrong that there wasn't racism in the United States? I don't know. The State Department does its best. Back at the end of the 60s, I had an interesting debate with a doctoral student at UCLA. He was an expert in ethnomusicology. He studied the music of people who were non-literate, and his specialty was Thailand. And in fact, he was working under a grant from RAND Corporation at the time. And also the U.S. government. RAND started out as being part of the U.S. government. Now it's independent, but it really does almost all its work for the U.S. government. And I said, really? What are you investigating? And he said, well, you wouldn't be interested in it. He knew I was interested in politics. He said, it's just, you know, the music of the Thai people. And I said, well, exactly what goes on? He said, well, I'm interested in troubadours, people we would consider troubadours. These are sort of poet musicians who make their living by going from village to village, sort of spreading the news. Because they didn't have television, most didn't have radio, there was no internet, they didn't even have telephones. This was the traditional newspaper of preliterate people. So I said, really? They spread the news? He said, yeah, that's how they find out what's going on in Bangkok and maybe Myanmar or Burma or Malaysia or Vietnam, places like that. So I said, oh, and this is apolitical? You're finding out who these people are, what their names are, where they live or where they circulate around, and what kind of messages they put out. And you're giving this ultimately to the CIA or the State Department. And they're going to see to it that the appropriate troubadours are contacted and given money to, you know, wander around, or maybe they'll be given scooters or whatever. And that's going to have an influence on the orientation of these people, who in turn are going to influence people who can't read and write and, you know, have never left their village in their lifetime. It's going to be put in terms that they understand, with mythology and gods and, you know, musical forms and their kind of poetry. But basically, you know, you're just part of a propaganda effort. There's nothing abstract or humanitarian about what you're doing. You're a pawn in someone else's game. And he and I didn't communicate too well after that, because he wanted to believe himself to be above the fray. I mean, there were a lot of student demonstrations and, you know, marches and stuff going on. And it's not that he didn't approve of them. He didn't want to get involved with them because it could have damaged his academic career or post-academic career. And so he convinced himself that, you know, he was just this innocent ethnomusicologist working in a very obscure field that had no implications at all. Turned out it had tremendous implications because Rand Corporation was sponsoring many, many people like this. And so was the CIA. And so were various defense intelligence agencies. They wanted to know what people were thinking so they could influence that thought. To what degree could they influence it? Well, who knows? But they were making the effort. And they would have agreed with Marx that everything is political, ultimately, that ideas that seem to be quite innocent, if you look behind the scenes, are not quite so innocent. You look at American movies, and I confess I go to lots of movies. I've written sort of a book on them. I mean, there's no movie that doesn't have a complete cosmology or ideology to it. The hero of an action movie is invariably white and some kind of a professional, maybe a cop or someone like that. He's in a position of authority, and he has sidekicks that are generally female or non-white, and they're fighting for some, I don't know, capitalist conception of what's good. If there's a villain, it could be a capitalist, but that's the rotten apple in the barrel. If you just get rid of this Mr. Big, then things will be fine. So at every step of the way, you're seeing what could be called bourgeois ideology. And people go into these things just wanting escapist entertainment, but while they're escaping, they're also being trapped. You could say that capitalism is always organizing a prison break. And its version of a prison break is that the prisoners tunnel from block 17 and they find themselves in block 18, where the furniture is a little different, but they never escape the prison. It's more effective probably than the kind of propaganda that the Nazis put out or the Soviet Union put out, where everyone knew it was propaganda and they didn't think it was escapist entertainment. It wasn't very entertaining. It was like with a sledgehammer. But Warner Brothers and 20th Century Fox are much more effective, much more. In fact, Heinrich Himmler, who was the head of Hitler's propaganda machine, watched Hollywood movies incessantly. He was awed by it. He said the power of these movies is amazing. And the Nazis were never able to produce anything like that because Himmler's heavy hand was on every frame. Everyone knew that, you know, what was going on, and even Hitler conceded that his movies could not play in any other country than Germany. It was just so obviously propagandistic and ridiculous that no one would accept it. Whereas people all over the world are eager for the latest Harry Potter or, you know, whatever it may be.
You mean Goebbels, don't you?
I'm sorry, Goebbels. You know, Himmler was different. Yeah, I get the Nazis confused. So, in a nutshell, that's the materialist conception of history, and it's obviously not hard to understand. Why it isn't taught has nothing to do with the difficulty of understanding it. General relativity is much more difficult to understand. There's no reputable university in the country that's not teaching that, but somehow they missed out on Marx.
You have been listening to Dr. Ira Sohn's lecture, titled The Materialist Conception of History. This completes part one of the full three-part program. It was recorded on June 18th of 2004 in Santa Monica, California. The talk was sponsored by the Southern California Federation of Scientists and the Monthly Review Discussion Group. Dr. Sohn holds degrees in physics and economics and currently teaches economics at universities both in the U.S. and China. This program was produced by the L.A. Sound Posse. The L.A. Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.